My favorite thing about introducing a panel is when before I start speaking, I can already hear the room get quieter. But I have been given the go-ahead from our fearless leader to go ahead and introduce our moderator for the next panel and continue filibustering long enough for people to make it all the way to their seats, with the possible exception of those with Article 3 commissions. I'm just going to uncomfortably stare at Judge Walker. I promised that you would see far too much of me today, and so I am back. It is my pleasure to introduce a moderator for our Supreme Court preview and review, Judge John K. Bush. Judge Bush is a circuit judge for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. You will notice a theme here. He keeps his chambers in Louisville. Prior to joining the court, Judge Bush was a partner in the Louisville office of Bingham, Greenbaum, and Dahl, where he was co-chair of the firm's litigation department. He began his legal practice in Washington, D.C. at Gibson Dunn. He served as a law clerk to Judge J. Smith Heaney from the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, so shout out to all of my fellow Eighth Circuit alums, though it might just be the two of us. He graduated summa cum laude from Vanderbilt University in 1986 and cum laude from Harvard Law School in 1989. He is also the former president of the Louisville chapter of the Federalist Society Lawyers Division. So with that, I will turn it over to Judge Bush.
Thanks, Phil. So as we begin this last panel of the day, I'm reminded of Justice Robert Jackson's quote, "We are not final because we are infallible, but we are infallible only because we are final." We are the final panel today. But seriously, we do have some people on our panel that are quite qualified on the subject at hand, and I'll briefly introduce them, and then we're going to take a different approach to the panel than some of the other panels. It's going to be more of just a question and answer, and so I'll pose some questions, and then hopefully we'll have some time at the end for questions from the audience. We're, of course, previewing the Supreme Court term. And some of these cases have already been argued, but we're going to go through, and we have a very capable panelists. The first is Sarah Campbell, who is Associate Solicitor General and Special Assistant to the Attorney General in the Tennessee Attorney General's Office. And she, before that, had been an associate at Williams & Connolly in Washington, and she also clerked for Justice Sam Alito and Judge Bill Pryor on the 11th Circuit. Our next panelist is John Elwood, who is a partner at Arnold & Porter in the Washington office, where he heads the firm's appellate and Supreme Court practice. And he's argued many times before the Supreme Court and is a graduate of Princeton and Yale Law School. And he served as a law clerk to Justice Anthony Kennedy, and also served in the U.S. Department of Justice as an assistant to the U.S. Solicitor General and as the senior deputy in the Office of Legal Counsel. He has taught at University of Virginia's School of Law for the Supreme Court Litigation Clinic, and he writes the Realist Watch feature on SCOTUS blog. And our final panelist is Matt Kuhn, who is the Principal Deputy Solicitor General in the Office of the Kentucky Attorney General. He previously served as Deputy General Counsel for the Governor of Kentucky. He worked at Jones Day and at Stahl Keenan Ogden. He graduated from Furman and Columbia Law School and clerked for Judge Ray Grunder on the Eighth Circuit. So I forgot we have another Eighth Circuit alum. So perhaps this panel should be on the Eighth Circuit, not the Supreme Court. But I'll begin, Matt, with you, because I think of everyone on the panel, you've been before the Supreme Court most recently, in fact, last week. So this was the case Cameron versus EMW. Without getting into the merits of that case, if you can maybe tell us what your experience was like and just give us something of an image of what the court is doing these days.
Sure. Thank you, Judge Bush. So the Supreme Court, after doing telephone-only arguments last term, is back to in-person with a couple of twists that I'll explain. But they are back to in-person. The courthouse itself is only open to arguing counsel and co-counsel. And so if you've been to Argument Day at the Supreme Court of the United States in the past, it's normally teeming with people. You've got the folks in the lawyer's line to get in the lawyer's lounge. You've got the folks going in line to do 2 minutes of argument viewing and go out. None of that anymore. It's basically empty when you walk in. And as a lawyer who's arguing a case, you don't actually know if you're going to get to argue in person until about 1 p.m. or so the day before. So you have to fly up early and get a COVID test at 8 a.m. the morning before your oral argument. And the Supreme Court's COVID testing center is just a little testing center off of K Street, nothing special about it. And you find out at about 1 p.m. the day before if you're going to argue in person. And if you have a positive COVID test, you have to be prepared to argue via telephone, and your opponent, assuming they have a negative COVID test, gets to argue in person. So you have to really have to be prepared for both eventualities. Thankfully, I got a negative COVID test. So argument at the court looks similar to how it was before COVID, where you have free-for-all questioning from all of the justices. But the twist that you have now is they have, at the conclusion of both arguments, each justice has the ability to ask questions in order of seniority. And so we've seen that sort of follows on how the telephone arguments work. So generally, you're not done when you actually finish your principal argument. You've got what they're calling seriatim questioning at that point. So the arguments are running about an hour, maybe a little bit over. One of the neat things that I think we've seen so far in the 2 weeks that we've had arguments is that oftentimes Justice Thomas is asking the first question. And his questions are invariably to the point and insightful, and in many cases are defining how the rest of oral argument goes. So we've got 2 weeks of oral argument done in October, and the November group will be starting soon after that.
John, you clerked on the Supreme Court and have had many arguments before them. Would you say the format today compares to when you've been before them in the past, and is it an improvement?
Well, I think it's better in some ways, and I don't know if I want to say worse in some ways, but it's definitely harder in some ways. One thing I think that is an improvement is that I clerked in OT 96, October term 96, when Chief Justice Rehnquist was running the show, and we used to joke that there was a trap door in front of the lectern, and when the light turned red, it opened. I mean, like, you were lucky to get 7 seconds to wrap up, and they should have him run the Oscars. He really moves people along. But I think it's better in the sense that the new Chief Justice is a guy who used to appear as an advocate there, I think is more understanding about the need sometimes to expand argument and give people a little bit more leeway. The thing that I think is the challenge is that it's gotten a hotter and hotter panel. I think that there is smarter justices as have ever been on the court, but they ask more trenchant questions, but they don't give the advocates a lot of room to answer. I think they gave them more room for a while during the telephonic arguments. I haven't really gotten a good sense of how they are in the kind of post-telephonic era. But one thing I thought was kind of telling is I took about a 5-year gap when I was at the Office of Legal Counsel between when I had arguments as a public lawyer when I started having them again as a private lawyer. And the conventional wisdom when I quit in 2005 was you needed a 2-sentence answer for every question. And I discovered that was twice as long as you really needed when I started again in, whenever it was, 2011 or something like that. And I think, you're there to answer their questions, and so maybe that's the way it should be. But I think it'd be nice if you could really get that second question or second sentence or third answer, even third sentence.
Sarah, you clerked for Justice Alito. How does it appear to you today how arguments are going as to when you were clerking there?
Yeah, so I think it was in 2019 that the court began allowing, 2 minutes of uninterrupted argument time or argument at the very beginning of the advocate's oral argument. And, that's probably the biggest change since I clerked in OT 2011. And I from an advocate's perspective, I would say that that's pretty valuable to be able to have that uninterrupted time to actually get out the points that you think are important. I know that there are some Supreme Court practitioners out there who disagree with that, who think, I think as John just suggested, you know, you're there to answer the justice's question. So, you know, if you're not actually answering a justice's question with that uninterrupted time, then maybe it's not that valuable after all. But, you know, just historically, the justices have jumped in with questions really, really quickly, and that must be frustrating, I think, from an advocate's perspective. Who, you know, you're representing your client, and you have you know, arguments that your client wants and needs to make. So that's a pretty big change, and I mean, I think that's actually a good change because, and from the public, you know, the public who's listening to these arguments, you know, that allows an advocate the opportunity to kind of set the stage and to explain in a nutshell what the case is about and what really are, you know, the salient parts of the advocate's argument.
Sarah, I'm going to stick with you for the next question. We'll jump into the first case, which is the headliner, I believe, for this term, Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, which involves the constitutionality of a Mississippi law that restricts elective pre-viability abortions. So, Sarah, you're in an AG office of a state that may have an interest in this case. What would you say the significance of Dobbs is to your defense of abortion regulations in your state?
It's hard to overstate the significance, truly. You know, Tennessee, like many states across the country, you know, has enacted some more restrictive abortion laws in recent years that push, if not cross, the viability line that Casey set out. You know, I think the activity of state legislatures in this area is such strong evidence that the viability line is not working. And that, you know, there is a lot of just popular support for more restrictive abortion laws. So, you know, from my office's perspective, you know, we are really hoping for a decision that, you know, if it doesn't overrule Roe and Casey, that does rework the viability standard in a way that gives states the flexibility they need to respond to changes on the ground in, you know, scientific evidence and understanding, and just to respond to, you know, the popular will about what laws are needed in this area.
Matt, what about your state?
I agree with that, and I think what's different is Mississippi's merits brief, for the first time since Casey, asked the court to overrule Roe and Casey. It's hard to, as Sarah said, it's hard to overstate the significance of that. And so this is not like the intervening abortion decisions that we've had since Casey. This is not Gonzalez. This is not June Medical. This is not Hellerstedt. The court is going to take a fresh look through the stare decisis factors at this. And I think it has the ability to very much affect the legislation that Kentucky's defending in our courts and perhaps end some of those challenges. And I think as evidence of that, you're starting to see states or abortion litigation that they're just staying the case to await for a decision in Dobbs, even though we could, you know, these stays were starting to be entered in litigation. For example, Arkansas's litigation in the Eighth Circuit, they stayed it almost a year before we're going to find out about Dobbs. So I think there's a recognition that things may very well change.
I'll throw this out for all three of you. What do you think? Can you hazard a prediction of what you think the court will do? Do you think the court will reaffirm Casey or come up with something else?
My prediction, I think Mississippi is going to win. I'm not quite sure how big they're going to win. So the law at issue, just to orient, is prohibits abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. And one of the interesting parts about this case is that Mississippi has one abortion clinic, and they only do abortions up to 16 weeks. So for the state of Mississippi, we're only talking about abortions during 1 week of pregnancy that are affected by this. But, for example, in Kentucky, where abortion clinics perform abortions up to 21.6 weeks LMP, it's going to have, I think, perhaps a greater effect. Two more points about it. First, quickly, there are some commentators out there that are of the opinion that this is very much an all-or-nothing issue for the court, They're either going to have to reaffirm Roe and reaffirm Casey, or they give it back to the states completely. A couple of things that I would be looking at right now to think about how the court's going to do it are several of the justices' separate opinions about stare decisis. We saw Kavanaugh write a great separate opinion in the Ramos case out of Louisiana about stare decisis and focusing on not whether a precedent is wrong, but whether it's egregiously wrong. And I think one of the most interesting stare decisis decisions that Mississippi has cited repeatedly is Chief Justice Roberts' decision from the Citizens United case. And one of the things that he said in his Citizens United concurrence I think is really interesting for stare decisis is that when the court applies an intervening decision without being asked to overrule it, that does not count to the Chief Justice from a stare decisis perspective. So the fact that the court has applied Casey in Gonzalez, Hellerstedt, and June Medical, from his perspective, that does not weigh in favor of stare decisis when it comes to Roe and Casey. So I think those two opinions are ones that I would look at very closely as I think about what's going to happen in Dobbs.
You know, I try to be an optimist in life in general, but I'm having a hard time being an optimist in this particular situation. You know, I think it is likely that Mississippi will win. I agree with Matt on that score. I think it's less likely that we will see, you know, Roe and Casey being completely overruled. I think what I struggle with is figuring out, you know, what else the court might do. And the reason I have trouble figuring that out is, you know, the viability standard is, of course, was just completely made up, as is the right to abortion. It's completely made up. So anything else, any other standard that we have in this area is likewise going to be completely made up. If it's, you know, anything short of an outright, you know, overruling of the right to abortion. So, you know, it's hard to see how some of the justices who are not inclined to make up legal rules of that sort, you know, are going to get there, and what that rule might look like, you know, unless it's some sort of like substantial burden standard that just kind of applies throughout without regard to viability, that would allow states, you know, more leeway to regulate before viability. But so that's my prediction is Mississippi will win. We'll have some new standard that will probably be equally unworkable.
So I think I agree that Mississippi will win. My general sense is that they're not going to get 5 votes to affirm, you know, Casey as it is. But my own thought is that there's going to be some sort of small ball answer here. Particularly because there's only like a week difference between the law and what the clinic's actual practices are. And keep in mind that, you know, the Chief Justice Roberts generally likes to do at least one warning shot before overruling anything. It took, you know, there was a Northwest Austin Municipal Utilities District before they overruled Section 5 of they struck down Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. It took them 3 tries to, you know, overrule Abood versus Detroit Board of Education, and so I think they'll probably do the same thing here. I also wouldn't rule out the possibility of something weird happening, like dismissing as improvidently granted, because this case was petitioned, Mississippi petitioned, with a much different view. They thought they still had Ginsburg on the court at the time they petitioned, and it was much more along the lines of how you can uphold this even consistent with Casey. And so there's like one footnote in the petition that said, you know, and by the way, you could also maybe reconsider Casey. And when they came back for merits briefing, it was very full-throated, reconsider Casey. And in the past, in cases like Visa versus Osborne, the court has used that as perhaps as a fig leaf to get rid of a case and say, you know, this changed from the way you presented it to us, and so we're just not going to address it. But, you know, all I can say here is I overuse this, but Niels Bohr, the physicist, said prediction is difficult, especially about the future.
John, I'm going to stick with you for my next question, and then the other panelists can join in as well. As you know, in abortion cases and other areas, Justice Thomas has often staked out solitary or minority positions. Do you foresee that changing with the new additions to the court? Are we moving from a Roberts court to a Thomas court?
Well, definitely Justice Thomas has more company because he was really kind of a lone dissenter for a long time. And now, he definitely has Gorsuch and Alito as wingmen, although I don't know if you would dispute that or not. Maybe that goes the other direction. Who knows? But one thing I think, I think that generally things are trending in a more conservative direction to the point that they no longer need, the real conservatives on the court no longer need Chief Justice Roberts to provide a fifth vote. But one thing I think you can't count out is before he was Chief Justice, John Roberts was one of the most highly paid Supreme Court advocates because he was very good at persuading Supreme Court justices. And as a young appellate lawyer in D.C., we unironically called him God, the way that people used to call Eric Clapton God in the 60s. And one thing I just will point out is that in the last couple of terms, the Chief Justice has had an extra opinion from a sitting where one of his more conservative colleagues had no opinions, suggesting that the case flipped after conference and went from being 5-4 where he was in the dissenter to being 5-4 where he was in the majority. And I think it's also, I don't know whose votes flipped, maybe his flipped, I don't know, although it's probably unlikely. But and then consider the fact that he and Brett Kavanaugh vote together something like 95% of the time. So it may be that he, only has to persuade one person in order to flip a case 5-4. This hasn't really worked in cases with a real ideological valence. But the cases I'm thinking of are the Georgia Code copyright case, Georgia versus publicresources.org, and then last term, the Penny's Pipeline case involving eminent domain. So, not really big ticket items, but just show that you can't count them out yet.
Sarah or Matt, do you want to weigh in?
I think another opinion from last term that shows us the Chief Justice's ability to move the court the way he wants is the Fulton decision. Everybody thought that was going to be a broad, bitterly divided decision, and it turned out to be a very narrow consensus one. And I think that the Chief's opinion there is just sort of trademark the Chief Justice. And I think he uses his ability to assign opinions when he's in the majority. I think he uses it quite brilliantly. And so I think he very much, I think it very much still is the Roberts court. I mean, that's not to say that there aren't instances where the Chief Justice is in dissent with the five more conservative members of the court. We saw that in some of the COVID litigation that's been talked about, the Roman Catholic Archdiocese case, the Tandon case, and we've seen it, in Texas's Senate Bill 8, first version of it. We're about to get the second version of that. So it's not to say that the Chief Justice is going to be in the majority all the time or that he's going to wield sort of the persuasive power that he has. But he's still very much the Chief Justice. I do think that where we're going to see a change is perhaps in the cases where certiorari is granted with the addition of Justice Barrett on the court. I think there will be more cert grants in cases without taking into account how the Chief Justice is going to vote on things. I do think we're going to see a change in the court certiorari docket. We're going to see more cases granted that perhaps would not have been granted before Justice Barrett was on the court.
Why don't you pass the mic over to Sarah? I want to ask you the next question, but you can also weigh in on this as well, Sarah. But I wanted to go ahead and get into the next case, which is City of Austin v. Reagan National Advertising of Texas. So this case bears eerie similarity to a case you had in the Sixth Circuit a few years ago, Thomas v. Bright. So in light of that, your background in the area, explain to us what the case is about, what the controversy is about, and what you think the court is going to do in the case.
Sure. I'll say Tennessee had a very similar case, and so did Kentucky.
We both lost.
So the issue in City of Austin is whether a distinction between on-premises and off-premises signs is content-based and therefore subject to strict scrutiny under the First Amendment. So what is an on-premises sign? Think McDonald's arches, right? It's something that's advertising. It's a sign that's advertising something that's happening on that site, on those premises. So in City of Austin, it's not kind of an outright off-premises, on-premises distinction. The issue in City of Austin is whether, so in general, Austin sign code prohibits off-premises signs. So it allows on-premises, prohibits off-premises. But there are certain signs that have been non-conforming signs that have been grandfathered in. So the signs at issue are off-premises signs that are grandfathered in. And because they are off-premises signs, they are not allowed to digitize those signs. So it's an on-premises, off-premises distinction in the context of digitization of signs.
That's because the digitization came about after the original signs were
exactly.
put in place.
Okay. Exactly. So they now want to, you know, convert them to be a little bit more modern, but the city's not allowing them to do so because they have to kind of, they can't enlarge or expand, you know, what they're doing with the sign since it's non-conforming. So to kind of understand what's happening in this case and why it's important, I think it's helpful to backtrack a little bit to 2014. So y'all may remember a case called Reed versus Town of Gilbert that was before the Supreme Court in 2014. So this was also involved a sign code, but it was a sign code that kind of generally, it was a city sign code that generally prohibited signs, but then it exempted like two dozen categories of signs, including political signs, you know, temporary directional signs, ideological signs. So there are all these different categories. And the Supreme Court, you know, held that is content, that those exemptions were content-based on their face and did not satisfy strict scrutiny. And so the important legal point from that case is that a law can be content-based on its face and therefore subject to strict scrutiny, even if the justification for the law is content neutral. So the court didn't really elaborate a whole lot on how to tell whether something is content-based on its face, and kind of we're seeing that play out in the aftermath of Reed, especially in the context of this on-premises, off-premises distinction. So in the Reed decision, though, Justice Alito, who was in the majority, in Reed, wrote a separate concurrence that was joined by two of the other justices in the majority that provided kind of some examples of how cities can still, you know, regulate signs. And he gave some examples of things that would not be content-based for purposes of the First Amendment. And in that list of things that would not be content-based are signs that or laws that distinguish between on-premises and off-premises signs. So we see, you know, litigation unfold after Reed, you know, challenging different sign laws. And among those laws that were challenged were Tennessee's Highway Beautification Act and Kentucky's. What's yours called? Okay. So two laws. In Reed, so the United States filed an amicus brief in Reed saying, we think that Gilbert's sign law is unconstitutional, but the Federal Highway Beautification Act is not. So the Federal Highway Beautification Act conditions some of the state's transportation funding on enacting state legislation that restricts billboards on the side of interstates. And that law allows states to, requires states to limit outdoor advertising alongside interstates, but they can exempt on-premises signs. So the Federal Highway Beautification Act contains this very on-premises, off-premises distinction that's at issue in the City of Austin case. So that was kind of lurking in the background, I think, of Reed. So we've had these cases pop up, including the Tennessee and Kentucky case. The Sixth Circuit held in both of those cases that the on-premises, off-premises distinction in these state highway beautification acts are unconstitutional, that they're content-based. And so that issue is now before the Supreme Court in City of Austin. And, you know, I think the main arguments that it's not content-based is that this is really about location. This isn't singling out a particular subject matter for differential treatment. It's just, you know, it's just limiting where certain messages can be displayed. On the other, you know, on the other side, you've got, well, this is a particular subject matter. You know, it's you're restricting people from advertising things that are happening on, or you're allowing advertising about things that are happening on the property and not allowing, you know, any other message. So there's the narrow question of the on-premises, off-premises distinction. There's also a slightly broader question at issue, which is how do you go about determining whether something is spatially content-based? A few circuits have adopted what seems to be like an officer must read it test, that if when you're enforcing the law, you have to look at what's on the sign or, you know, on whatever the object is that's being regulated to determine whether it's subject to regulation, that it must be content-based. And other circuits have, you know, taken a slightly different approach. So that's so there's the specific question, and then, you know, maybe we'll get some clarity about how you go about figuring out whether something is content-based on its face.
So any prediction?
You know, I think, yeah, I'll just refer to John's quote from a few moments ago, but, you know, the court has, the trend in the court's recent jurisprudence has been to robustly protect freedom of speech. And, you know, I think that one of the things that the court will be concerned with is, you know, is there a way for states and localities to reasonably regulate signs if we say that this is content-based? And if you look at the respondent's brief in this case, and interestingly, it's so Canon Shamagam is representing the respondents in this case, he has previously represented the Outdoor Advertising Association of America in some other cases, and their position has been different in some of the past cases. So the Outdoor Advertising Association has actually kind of flipped on this and is now arguing in the Supreme Court that this is unconstitutional. So that's just kind of an interesting side note. But, you know, I think if the court can be assured that there is a way for government to enact reasonable sign regulations so that we don't just have a proliferation of, you know, tacky billboards on the side of the interstate and, you know, on the side of highways all over the place, then I predict that the court will say this is content-based and that it does not survive strict scrutiny. And, you know, I'll also just note a number of states, including Tennessee, have amended their laws to get rid of their on-premises, off-premises distinctions. Tennessee amended its law, and now it has that distinction, but it redefines it to say that something is on-premises if it's located at a certain distance from the building and the sign owner or operator is not receiving any compensation to display the message.
Okay, very interesting. Let's move on to the Second Amendment case, which, John, I wanted to ask you about. That is New York State Rifle Association v. Bruin. And what's the issue there, and how significant do you think this case is going to be for Second Amendment jurisprudence?
So this is a case out of New York, and I think that this may be an illustration of what Matt said, that the court's changing membership may have implications for the docket, the court's docket, because the court, they got a kind of a rap for ducking Second Amendment cases for years, causing Thomas, Gorsuch, and Alito to all say that it was a second-class right. And merely the fact that they're taking this is an indication that they have four votes to do that. But the case is kind of a follow-on to Heller, District of Columbia versus Heller, which involved whether the Second Amendment covers the right to essentially, you know, carry arms or possess arms at home to protect yourself. And this is talking about an open carry law in New York. And in New York, you have to be one of a particular class of persons that, in order to do that, and you have to be like a merchant or something like that, or otherwise you have to demonstrate a proper cause to law enforcement agents. Second Circuit said that's just fine. You know, really, the Second Amendment is mostly about a right to possess at home. And, you know, there are, under intermediate scrutiny, there's good reasons why you wouldn't want people carrying guns out on the street. Challengers say, you know, bare arms doesn't stop at your door. It involves a matter of possessing, and you should be able to carry it outside. And it belongs to the people. It doesn't belong to people with proper cause. And so, therefore, this is an unconstitutional regulation. The $64,000 question is exactly what the conception of the Second Amendment right is. You know, this was already at the time that Heller happened, one of the least kind of examined amendments to the Constitution aside from the third. So there really isn't that much to look at to see what exactly the parameters of the right are. I think it's an interesting case because, as you may have heard, a group of, you know, kind of prominent conservatives, most prominent of which is former Fourth Circuit Judge Luttig, Don Ayer, former Deputy Attorney General, Stuart Gerson, who is at like every moot court I ever attend at the Heritage Foundation, have filed a brief saying, you know, trying to go it from the conservative originalist angle, saying there are conservative originalist arguments for upholding restrictions on carrying guns in public. There's a little bit of hinting in Heller itself where they said, oh, well, you know, it's fine to prohibit concealed carry and it's fine to, you know, have prohibitions on carrying guns in sensitive areas like schools and legislatures. And I remember some other language which my achy-old brain can't reproduce about, you know, particularly fearsome weapons or things like that that you might be able to regulate. But other than that, there hasn't been a whole lot of guidance about what that's going to look like. So my only prediction is this will be interesting.
Okay, that's a diplomatic response.
Yeah.
Matt, I wanted to ask you about Carson v. Macon, which concerns government aid for religious schools. Tell us about that case, and how is this different than the Espinoza case that the court decided last year?
So Carson, the way to think about Carson is it's sort of the final part of what I think of as a religion clause trilogy of cases. The first was Trinity Lutheran that came before the court a couple of years ago that dealt with the scrap tire program out of the state of Missouri, and a church applied for a scrap tire grant, and the court, the state of Missouri, excluded them because they were a church, and the court, by a lopsided vote in that instance, said that wasn't okay. Then we got Espinoza last year, which was about Montana's no-aid provision. Now we've got Carson. So let me try to put together this trilogy so you can understand it. So at issue in Carson is Maine's, what they call their town tuitioning program. And so Maine does not have a public secondary school in essentially every school district. But what they do is that if there's not a public school there, Maine will pay for you to go to another secondary school. And that's why it's called town tuitioning. And parents can choose where to send their children. With one exception is that they cannot send their children with state dollars to a secondary school that the state decides is sectarian. So this is the most important part of the case. So the fact that you are, you know, Maine Lutheran Secondary School, that does, the fact that you're affiliated with the Lutheran Church does not mean that you're sectarian. So it's not a religious status distinction. Instead, it's a religious use distinction, and I'll explain what that means. So the way Maine describes it is that they have a state official decide whether the secondary school, and I'm quoting here, promotes the faith or belief system with which the school is associated and or presents the material taught through the lens of faith. And so Missouri's state official looks at whether essentially you're teaching for a Christian school, teaching about the resurrection or the crucifixion, and whether you're weaving that into your state program. So there may very well be Christian schools that you can send your children to under Maine's program, but if the state decides they're teaching too much religion there, they're not allowing that to happen. So let me put this in the context of the trilogy that I talked about. So we started with Trinity Lutheran, and the court there was very much focused on religious status, that the Missouri church was excluded because it was a church. And Justice Gorsuch there wrote a really interesting concurrence where he said, I agree that you cannot discriminate based on religious status, and that's subject to strict scrutiny. But for me, Justice Gorsuch said, I don't see much of a distinction between use, what's at issue in Carson, and status. So he wrote this interesting concurrence that people started thinking about. So then we got the Espinoza decision, which the judge asked about, and Espinoza was Montana's case. And like in Trinity Lutheran, Montana distinguished based on religious status, not based on religious use. That is to say, Montana's constitutional provision discriminated against private religious schools because they were religious, not because they did religious things like praying and studying the Bible. So Espinoza, the majority opinion that Chief Justice Roberts wrote, talked about the status-use distinction. And they said, we're not reaching the status-use distinction because we're talking about religious status here. And basically they said, don't take us not opining on this to suggest that religious use is subject to lesser scrutiny under the First Amendment. So Justice Gorsuch, like he did in Trinity Lutheran, wrote separately, this time more at length, spelling out why he doesn't see a difference between religious status and religious use. So then, after we got Espinoza, that's where the case that we have this term picks up. And the First Circuit there said, okay, we don't have religious status, so it's not subject to strict scrutiny. Like Trinity Lutheran and Espinoza, we've got religious use, and so they applied lesser scrutiny to uphold Maine's town tuitioning program. So this, I think, is just a fascinating case. We talked about incrementalism. John mentioned some of that. This is very much incremental. In Trinity Lutheran, the court could have, you know, blown through the doors and said religious use is religious status and they're all barred. But over a series of years, the court has crafted very narrow opinions to get us to where we are. I think one of the most interesting discussion points that we're going to see on December 8th during oral argument is how the Supreme Court deals with the Locke versus Davy case, sort of central to the briefing and to the argument. So Locke was written by then Chief Justice Rehnquist, and it was a lopsided majority. It was 7-2. My memory is that only Scalia and Thomas dissented. And it dealt with Washington's program. Washington had a program that funded some sorts of college education, with the exception that if you were going to get a degree in devotional theology, you could not get state funding for that particular degree. And so it was focused on one particular use of the state funding. And so Maine says, okay, you've got distinguishing based on use, so because Washington could do it, we can do it as well. So it'll be really interesting to see what, if anything, the court does with Locke versus Davy. They've distinguished it in Trinity Lutheran and in Espinoza, and the challengers to Maine's program actually asked the court to overrule it. I don't think the court's going to overrule Locke versus Davy. I think we're going to get, my prediction is we're going to get a sort of narrow reading of it that says Locke versus Davy dealt with only one particular use, whereas now we've got sort of across the board use, distinction based on use. So I think my prediction is that Maine's going to lose probably going to lose pretty easily under Espinoza. My prediction is that Chief Justice Roberts, who's written both Trinity Lutheran and Espinoza, is going to write this opinion as well.
Okay, why don't you pass it back to Sarah, Mike. And I wanted to ask Sarah, you about Ramirez v. Collier, which is the other free exercise case before the court. Can you tell us what that's about, and also how the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act plays into it?
Sure. So Ramirez is about executions. So over the past few years, the court has issued a number of orders on its shadow docket, which we'll talk a little bit more about before we wrap up today. concerning, you know, what rights inmates have to have spiritual advisors present when they are executed. So back in 2019, there was an order in Dunn versus Ray. The court granted an application to vacate a stay of execution. So Alabama, lower courts had ordered Alabama not to execute an inmate. The court actually granted the application to vacate that because the inmate was dilatory. So not necessarily because of any, you know, reflection of the merit to the inmate's claim. But in that case, the inmate was Muslim and wanted to have a Muslim spiritual advisor, you know, of his own choice in the execution chamber. And Alabama wouldn't allow that. They would allow a Christian advisor, but not Muslim. So then in 2019, there was another order, Murphy versus Collier. In that one, so the court actually granted a stay of execution, and it was a kind of a similar issue involving an inmate who wanted a Buddhist spiritual advisor, but the state would only allow a Texas employee, like Texas employed, either Christian or Muslim chaplain in the execution chamber. And so the court actually stayed that execution. Justice Kavanaugh had a concurring opinion in that, concurring in the grant of the stay of execution, where he suggested to states that really you have two options. You can either allow inmates to have a spiritual advisor of their choice, or you can just not allow spiritual advisors in the execution chamber. So you could have them, you know, before, kind of immediately before the inmate is brought into the execution chamber, but not actually in the execution chamber. So Alabama and Texas, actually not sure what Alabama did, but Texas, I know, changed its policy to say we're just not going to allow spiritual advisors in the execution chamber. Turns out that was a no-go. So then there were a couple of more stay orders on the court shadow docket, most recent one being in 2021 in Dunn versus Smith, where an Alabama inmate was not allowed to have any spiritual advisor at all. So Alabama went the same route as Texas. So this Alabama inmate was not allowed to have any spiritual advisor in the execution chamber, and the court denied an application to vacate an injunction there. And the Justices Kagan, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Barrett all, you know, concurred in that denial of the application to vacate the stay. So Justice Kavanaugh and the Chief dissented and advised states to figure out a way to allow spiritual advisors into the execution chamber. So Texas changed its policy once again to allow spiritual advisors in the execution chamber, a spiritual advisor of the inmate's choice. So that brings us to the Ramirez case that's before the court this term. And in that case, the inmate can have the spiritual advisor that he wants, but he wants the spiritual advisor, the pastor, it's a Southern Baptist pastor in this case, he wants that pastor to be able to lay hands on him while he's being executed and being administered the lethal injection drugs, and to be able to audibly pray for him as the execution is taking place. And so that's the issue before the court in Ramirez, is whether, you know, and Texas is saying, you know, we can't do that because of, you know, security and safety reasons, you know, it having someone actually physically laying hands on the inmate as he's being executed would make it difficult to see. You know, there's a risk that having someone lay hands on the inmate could cause the IV to become dislodged. You know, there are all sorts of issues that could be created there. So the inmate is bringing claims under both the Free Exercise Clause and the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, or RLUIPA. Under RLUIPA, if the inmate shows that the government is substantially burdening his sincerely held religious beliefs, then the state or the government, you know, at issue has the burden of showing that what they're doing is the least restrictive means of furthering a compelling governmental interest. So in addition to, you know, figuring out whether RLUIPA is being violated here, I think the court's also going to be considering whether the inmate was dilatory and bringing these claims. So when an inmate is seeking equitable relief, you know, the court has to consider not just whether the claim is meritorious, but also, you know, whether there are equitable reasons why the inmate should not get relief. And the court has denied relief, you know, in past cases just because the inmate waited too long, you know, or there was evidence that there was some sort of gamesmanship going on. So we'll be seeing some consideration of that. And the United States actually filed an amicus statement of interest here in this case and suggested that the court remand back to the Fifth Circuit to have the Fifth Circuit, you know, consider those equitable factors in the first instance. And Texas is also arguing that that the inmate failed to adequately exhaust these claims through the Texas's grievance, prisoner grievance procedure, which is required under the Prison Litigation Reform Act. So a lot going on there. You know, it's an issue that I think is really important to states that are still conducting executions and trying to figure out, you know, what federal law actually requires.
I'd like to step back from a particular case to ask the next question for John. And now Sarah just mentioned the shadow docket, and this, I think the Ramirez case was taken off the shadow docket and put on the regular docket. But a lot of cases have not lately, particularly with relation to COVID and other issues in the last year or so. So John, can you tell us, I think most people know the shadow docket, but maybe just give us a brief summary of what that encompasses and address some of the critics' charges as to this might not be the right way to handle some cases.
So, as you may know, the shadow docket is the term coined by University of Chicago Professor Will Bode for basically everything other than the Supreme Court's merits docket, the cases that they grant for actual hearing, you know, and a decision by signed opinion, which can include, you know, dissents from denial, summary reversals, things of that sort, but also, I think, and most prominently, stays and injunctions and things like that. And the title comes from the foreword he wrote to an article about or a symposium about the Supreme Court. It's got to be about the most influential journal title since the greening of America. And you wonder what would have happened. His original title was Paying Attention to the Orders List. And a colleague said, rightly, that's a terrible name. You have to come up with a new name. It would be a whole different world. It would be a lot duller. There would be no hearings about paying attention to the orders list. But his basic point, Bode's basic point, which I think is sound, is that the stuff that's done on kind of a summary basis by, you know, the stays and the summary reversals tends to be briefed more poorly. It's you know, briefed quickly. They're not as extensive. There's not oral argument. And the explanations tend to be shorter. They can be a single word. They can be a couple of paragraphs. They can be at most a few pages. And so because of that, the decision-making is probably not as good as for other, you know, merits cases, and they may not be as explained as well. And I think those are valid points. But it's come to more attention because things have sped up. I think a lot of the, or rather that they're granting relief more often, particularly stays and injunctions in recent times. I think a lot of that is because there was just so much litigation against the Trump administration to stymie some of their signal policy initiatives, which led to nationwide injunctions. And so they went to the Supreme Court, you know, understandably trying to get those frozen up so that their signature initiatives would not be frozen the entire time when the administration is in office. You could easily tie these things up for 4 years, an entire presidential term. And they managed to have a pretty good track record in that they won far more often than they lost and managed to get stays that were put in place by the Ninth Circuit frequently, you know, put on hold so that the programs could go ahead during the meantime. I think a lot of the criticisms of the shadow docket involve more or less disagreement with how they're exercising their discretion. You know, in the old days, which is much of the time I was practicing was the old days, stays were issued fairly infrequently. They were issued for things like executions and once in a while for, you know, a very strong First Amendment case like the Pentagon Papers or something like that. But, you know, generally, you know, it was very, very hard to get the Supreme Court to stay something. There were very few cases where that happened. For example, when Maryland's routine DNA testing of arrestees was stayed, the Chief Justice let that go forward, and everyone sat up and said, well, that's interesting. When the Virginia governor, there was a stay of his sentence or whatever, I remember thinking, well, that's something. And I really thought, you know, when you get the Supreme Court to step in at that stage, it's really a pretty strong indication that the odds are good that you'll win when push comes to shove. But still, it, you know, it wasn't done very much. In more recent years, the Supreme Court did it a fair amount, frequently with the Chief Justice's vote to stay various bits of abortion legislation. So basically abortions could go forward while the challenge was pending. And so I think to a certain extent, people are just disagreeing with the fact that the Supreme Court now will do this for cases of free exercise. People similarly objected when, in relation to the new Texas law, that the Supreme Court didn't step in to stop it, largely because of the, you know, procedural weirdness of the Texas enforcement mechanism. But I think it's just, you know, in some sense, it might just be, or a lot of it is disagreement with the fact that they're using the their discretionary authority to do. And one of the interesting bits of commentary I heard was that they're treating abortion more or less like a normal right, because, you know, like even for rights that people say are favored rights, you know, the Supreme Court hasn't done a lot to stay things, restrictions on firearms, for example. Some people's objection is they're treating abortion just like a normal right as opposed to a favored right, like the First Amendment is sometimes a favored right, or, you know, understandably the death penalty, because once the case is mooted, there's no coming back from it. Mm-hmm. But in any event, it's an interesting thing, and I don't think they're still running way ahead of statistics, so it may be that once the Supreme Court gets a taste letting litigation proceed or not as they see fit, they may not be willing to give that up.
Mm. Okay, I feel like we're entering the final round of Jeopardy. So we need to have quick answers to get through the rest of our cases. And so I'm going to start with Matt, and I'm going to give you the list of cases I want each of you to talk about. So, Matt, I want you to talk about the Houston Community College System v. Wilson case. And then, John, if you could go over Chertliff v. Boston. And then, Sarah, if you could go over Hemp Hill v. New York. And we'll see how quickly we can do maybe a shadow docket approach to your answers.
So the Houston Community College case is a fitting venue to talk about this case. It deals with an elected body's ability to censure one of its members for his or her speech under the First Amendment's free speech clause. The facts of this are just fascinating. So we're talking here, the elected body is the elected board of a community college system in Houston. And this fellow named David Wilson was elected to the board in 2013. And he was very, very critical of the board and its other members. Let me give you a flavor of what he did. He filed several lawsuits against the community college. He orchestrated robocalls against his fellow board members. And he even hired a private investigator to look into his board members and the community college system. And Wilson's actions as a board member cost the community college system like over $300,000 in attorney's fees. So the board censured Wilson, said, you can't do that. And guess what he did? He'd already filed a lawsuit against him, so he amended one of his pleadings to sue the community college and said, well, you just censured me for my speech, and that violates the free speech clause. District court disagreed, but the Fifth Circuit reversed and said that a reprimand against an elected official for speech addressing a matter of public concern is actionable under the First Amendment. So the Fifth Circuit revived the case. The in-bank Fifth Circuit disagreed vigorously about what to do. Eight judges dissented, including Judge Ho, who wrote one of my favorite opinions that he's written. So this case is going to be argued on November 2nd and is going to tell us about what limits, if any, an elected body like Kentucky's General Assembly what limits you can place on their ability to censure a member for his or her speech. And given how heated political discussions are in this current world, I think this is just an interesting time for the court to look on it. I think the community college is going to win. I don't think the court likes dipping their toes into these heated political debates. You know, the response first speech is more speech, which is what we saw in the case. So I think the community college is going to win, probably on a very narrow basis.
So Shurtleff versus City of Boston is another kind of religion in the public square case. We used to have these about creches and Christmas displays. This one is about a flag. City of Boston has three flagpoles outside City Hall, one's for the U.S. flag, one's for POW/MIA, and one is the city flag. But they have let all sorts of organizations run their own flags up. I don't know that there was any record of them turning anybody else down before this case, including the Turkish flag, which has, of course, a crescent on it, the Portuguese flag, which has references to the crucifixion on it, and I think maybe the Bunker Hill flag, which has another type of cross. But the City of Boston turned down a Christian organization that wanted to put up their flag, which has a Latin cross on it, and they sued. The First Circuit said that's just fine because, first, that's government speech. And so just like a few years ago, Texas was allowed to, you know, prohibit or not allow the Sons of Confederate Veterans to have a license plate, Boston, by flying the flag, that becomes their speech, and so they get to pick what their speech is. And then secondly, the First Circuit said, well, you know, they have to be careful about an establishment. And so that's a good reason why to undo that. The Supreme Court has been extremely skeptical of basically not letting religious groups do what everybody else gets to do and using the Establishment Clause as a fig leaf. And so that may be the reason why they took the case. But it will be an interesting wrinkle about the whole government speech thing, just because the last time that happened, it was a 5-4 decision where Texas narrowly won, but it sure didn't look like it for a while, and it may be interesting to see whether the whole government speech angle is just a wild card in an area where ordinarily it would be a pretty easy win for the religious group.
All right, I've got Hemphill versus New York. So this is a Confrontation Clause case. New York, as a matter of state law, applies something called the opening the door doctrine. A lot of states have something similar. It's sort of an equitable evidentiary doctrine that says if a criminal defendant or a litigant sort of opens the door to a particular topic, then the other side can bring in evidence that would otherwise be inadmissible to sort of counter the evidence that the other side brought in. So this is distinct from, you've probably heard of the rule of completeness. This is a little bit distinct from the rule of completeness, which says, you know, if one party introduces part of a statement, then the other side gets to introduce the rest of it because we don't want to have, you know, an incomplete picture. But the opening the door doctrine is a little bit broader than that. You know, it doesn't have to pick. It can be different evidence altogether. It's not like part the rest of the statement from, you know, a single witness. It can be evidence, a statement from a different witness altogether. So New York applies this doctrine in a way. So in a case called People versus Reed from a few years ago, the New York courts, you know, applied this doctrine in a way that allowed even evidence that would otherwise, you know, that would violate the defendant's Confrontation Clause rights to come in. And so the issue here is whether or under what circumstances a criminal defendant who opens the door to responsive evidence also forfeits his right to exclude the evidence otherwise barred from the Confrontation Clause by the Confrontation Clause. So this case was argued in October, and you could tell that, you know, the justices were several of the justices were concerned about the rule of completeness. So, you know, New York probably went too far here in allowing, you know, a whole host of evidence to come in that might violate a defendant's Confrontation Clause rights. But there are situations in which we may, you know, want, like the rule of completeness, for example, we may want some evidence to come in, even if it would violate a defendant's Confrontation Clause right. So my prediction on this case is that we'll see a narrow opinion, you know, holding that The application of New York's rule in this situation did violate the Confrontation Clause, but reserving for another day. Other situations that are not before the court in this case, such as the rule of completeness.
Okay, John, if you could go over a couple of cases involving statutory issues. The first is CVS Pharmacy versus Doe, which is a disparate impact case. And then the other, actually two other cases involving the state secret privilege. If you could briefly address those.
Okay, I'm going to try to do these in lightning round fashion as well. So CVS Pharmacy versus Doe involves Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, which is incorporated by the Affordable Care Act as an enforcement mechanism. And it basically provides a disparate impact cause of action for plaintiffs alleging disability discrimination, but it only permits a cause of action for discrimination solely by reason of disability. This case involves, CVS administers a bunch of health plans, and for basically expensive specialized medicines, instead of just, you know, going and picking them up wherever, you basically have to get them mail order or from CVS. And because a group of patients with HIV/AIDS were kind of disproportionately affected by that, that is a lot of the people who wound up having to use this, mail order pharmacy, where patients with HIV/AIDS, they brought suit saying that they basically were, that this was, you know, had a disparate impact on them, and it essentially denied them the value of the benefit. And the district court threw it out, but the Ninth Circuit vacated and remanded, saying that there was a disparate impact cause of action. I think that this is probably a pretty flimsy claim for a disparate impact, because there's really not much of a very good textual claim, and I think that they'll get a certain amount of a tailwind because it really is a facially neutral cause of action. Now that brings us to the state secrets privilege. There are two state secrets privilege cases. Of course, that means that the state secret privilege holds that essentially when a lawsuit could disclose information that would harm the U.S. national security, the court more or less shuts down the lawsuit in order to protect the state secrets. There are two of them. One involves one of the people arrested after 9/11, who's like a, you know, some sort of somebody in the orbit of Osama bin Laden, who was purportedly held at a black site in Poland and tortured. He wants to give testimony in a criminal prosecution of a couple of the guys who oversaw the enhanced interrogation there, and. I think that they want a U.S. court to order the production of testimony from a couple of the folks, a couple of the people who were purportedly involved in the interrogation. The district court said no state secrets, and then the Ninth Circuit reversed, saying that basically we have to look at these assertions of state secrets with a skeptical eye, and the government sought certiorari, saying no, you should be deferential. When the CIA is telling you this is going to disclose state secrets, you shouldn't give a skeptical eye. They've already had argument on this one, and even though much of this information is in the public domain, in that the two people who purportedly ran this program or were involved in the program have already given testimony in other contexts, the justices seem surprisingly sympathetic to the federal government that it's a whole different thing if the government is essentially going along and you're more or less forcing the government to endorse this, including Justice Sotomayor, because she noticed that the federal government gave the Heisman to Poland when it asked for the same information, and it viewed this as kind of an end run around that, which offended her. The second case is FBI versus Fazaga, and that involves basically whether the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act overrules state secrets privilege or abrogates it, because the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act If the government has to notify any aggrieved person, any person whose communications have been intercepted, if they're going to use the foreign intelligence information collected through electronic surveillance, I think that means essentially use it in a court case or for some other purpose than for foreign intelligence. And the aggrieved person that may then move to discover, obtain, or suppress the evidence on the ground that it was unlawfully acquired. Now, FISA, the FISA Act, provides that if the Attorney General files an affidavit that disclosure would harm national security, the court shall, quote, notwithstanding any other law, unquote, review the surveillance material in camera and ex parte. And so the question presented is whether those FISA procedures displace the common law privilege. The Ninth Circuit said, yes, it does displace the common law privilege. And the government says, based on the, there's actually a presumption there that you don't displace privileges unless you say so with some level of clarity. And this case is a bunch of practicing Muslims who say that they were targeted because of their religion. And they're hoping to get discovery of this information. And the government's trying to shut it down, basically invoking state secrets privilege. So it'd be interesting to see which way it happens. Ordinarily, any case that comes out of the Ninth Circuit, I think it's a little bit of a tailwind because, and you know, candidly, the Supreme Court reverses between two-thirds and three-quarters of cases they get because they wouldn't take a lot of them if they didn't think there was some error there. But it will be very interesting to see what happens with these ones.
Matt, would you finish us off with a couple of cases involving tragic circumstances? The first one is Cacera, which is a Nazi theft of a painting by Pissarro from a family who were victims of the Holocaust. And the second is the Boston Marathon bomber case.
Sure. The first one is a lawsuit against the Kingdom of Spain by a woman who was essentially forced to give up a Pissarro painting in 1930s Germany. So she acquired the painting in 1900 directly from Pissarro's agent. And the plaintiff in the lawsuit originally, who's now passed away, was her grandson, who grew up seeing this beautiful painting in his grandmother's parlor. She was forced to sell the painting for $360 to get exit visas right before the war. And the painting just disappeared, and it reappeared in a museum sort of controlled by the Kingdom of Spain in 2000. And so we've had a lot of litigation about it. So the facts of it are just fascinating and deeply tragic. But the legal issue is very dry. It's a question of a choice of law. Does California choice of law apply, under which circumstance the family who originally owned the painting would win, or does federal common law apply, which would apply Spanish law under which the Kingdom of Spain has adversely possessed this painting? So this one will be argued this term. The second one, and I'll be just very brief, is the Boston Marathon bomber case. It was argued last Wednesday. The argument lasted more than 90 minutes, which was fascinating. It was much longer than normal under the new format. There are two issues there, but the issue that they really focused on was the district court's failure to allow the admission of an unsolved triple homicide that they believe the defendant's brother committed. The most interesting part of the oral argument was Justice Barrett, who asked the question that everybody was thinking, which is, the Biden Justice Department has got a federal moratorium on death penalties. Why are you in this court trying to reinstate the death penalty? So it was a very interesting question. The lawyer for the government said that they continue to believe the jury imposed a sound verdict. So we'll get a decision on that one. I think presumably the government's going to win on that, and the court will reinstate the death penalty.
I wish we had time for questions from the audience, but I see General Cameron is here, and so we're going to wrap this one up. Please join me in thanking our panel.